Thank you. What I am going to try to do today is to shrink into about 40 minutes a lot of what I do and what the eight units that report to me do on a day-to-day basis across the university. So to give you a sense of the complexity to which I deal with, I have facilities responsibilities, I have finance responsibilities, I have CIT responsibilities, technology responsibilities. I also oversee risk management and public safety. I have the treasurer's function, debt issuance. I have, what am I missing? One or two other things. But it is the nexus, if you will, across the institution of a majority of the administrative functions that help Cornell operate as a city. And because of the complexity of that, I have spent the last couple of years working on a rethinking of how not only Cornell could function conceivably as an institution of higher education, but how higher education more broadly should think about its administrative functions and how they should work in support of the tripartite missions of teaching, research, and service. And what you are going to hear a little bit about today from me is basically a set of conversations that I have been having with my units, with the people who report to me, not only at the senior executive level, but quite frankly, all the way down throughout the entire organization. Because I have a fundamental belief that really, not only is it am I responsible for establishing the vision, I'm also quite frankly responsible for engaging the people who work within my organization to buy into that model and to become advocates of that model. And so we'll talk a little bit today about the conversations that I've been having. We'll also talk a little bit by example of some of the things that we're doing so that you can get a sense of how we're trying to apply this, recognizing that what you will really be seeing is only a small slice of the kinds of things that we are doing. So we'll talk about beginning with the challenges that are facing higher education and to a certain degree how that may impact Cornell. We will look at what a higher education business model might look like generically, but more specifically how we might be able to apply that business model over time, more particularly to how I'm thinking of applying it through my organization. With examples of strategies that we are trying to employ as we go forward. Now, I have a number of slides here, and I will not talk to every single point on the slide. It's just the nature of when you put the materials like this together, you actually build your case over time, and so it's gotten a little bit robust, and I will try to just simply hit the high points and not belabor every point that's here. Let me begin with the sort of a statement that I'm sure everybody in this room understands, which is there's a lot of stress and strain within higher education today. We collectively, whether we are on the administrative side or the academic side, are facing growing pressures, but market pressures to be sure. But also financial pressures as we think about the needs of the institution, whether they are ones that we impose on ourselves as we think about where we want to expand fields of knowledge or where we want to expand service, or those that are given to us by the regulatory agencies or agencies that have some oversight responsibility for us. We have demands for greater transparency, for greater clarity as to where we stand as an institution, how we use the resources that we're provided, and to ensure that we are following our public role and mission that is given to us by our 501c3 status. And the fact of the matter is that higher education as a business model is probably changing much faster than any of us realize. I love to do this with groups that I talk to. I ask them to step back and think for a minute and to ask to think about how many of them can remember a time when you got to the month of July, you got through June, you got to July, and you know, gosh, we now have a month where basically we can take it easy. We don't have to go 24/7. We don't have to spend every waking minute of the day doing all those things, and we can actually step back and breathe and think a little bit, and yeah, maybe leave the office at 3:30 once in a while just to do a couple of extra errands, and it's amazing the number of hands that go up. And then I say, well, now how many of you are able to do that today? And they all go down. And I said, that happened to you without you even realizing that it happened to you. All of a sudden, the business model changed. The demands of your job changed right before your very eyes. And you didn't really understand what was happening to you until all of a sudden you could look at the rearview mirror and you found out that working in a higher education institution was a 24/7 job that went for 12 months a year. Now, I don't think it's any different for you than it is for the people that report to me. So the fact of the matter is the business model that we've been operating under has changed. It's changed for most of us in the length of time that we've been working in institutions of higher education. I'm not arguing it's bad. I'm not arguing that it's good. I'm just simply saying that the model changed. And how we adapt to that model, how we adjust to that model, how we think about how that model affects how we go about doing our job is absolutely critical. Because of the other stresses and strains that are placed on us, because of the resources that we're given, or because of the demands that are made on us by our clients, our customers, those people who are looking for us to provide them with services. And that's when I begin to talk about what I remember as affectionately as the 90s, where the motto was to figure out how we could cut our overhead costs without increasing our business risks, right? I mean, it was, how do you downsize your institution? How do you re-engineer out the excess such that you were lean and mean? The same thing was true in terms of reducing central administrative costs while increasing services. Demands didn't change. Actually, if you look at higher education, we're growing. I love to talk about the difference between the for-profit model and the not-for-profit model, except that there really isn't a difference, other than the fact that they're downsizing and refocusing and streamlining themselves so that they can be very clear to their stockholders exactly what it is that they do, while we spend most of our time figuring out what we're going to add. How we're going to expand? How are we going to include this new program? How are we going to be able to adjust to this new field of science? How are we going to build this brand new research building? In order to adapt to the model that we have to support, which is in many respects a model of expansion, demand for services with a smaller set of resources. Out of that, because we've downsized, because your job has changed, we actually can say with a straight face that we've increased employee productivity. No question about that. People are doing more. Some of it may be because we've provided you with the technology in order to be more productive. But some of it is just simply the fact that you may be coming to work at 7 o'clock in the morning, 7:30, and not going home till 6 o'clock at night. Jobs changed. Demands have changed. How does that affect the business model? How do we think about that business model? That's the world in which we live. And within all that, we have to recruit the next generation of administration for our institutions. I have a statistic for my group alone that says that within the next 10 years, up to 40% of the people that work within my organization, 2,000 of them, an organization of 2,000, 40% can retire. It is a major issue for us. in terms of thinking about how do we retrain the next generation to come in and have the skill sets in order to manage within an environment which is much less friendlier than it was when we all started so long ago. That's a challenge for my leadership team. It's a challenge for me. So, as I've already said, we really, you know, we have to think of ourselves as a business model, which is entirely different. And the point that I want to make off of this slide is that there is a significant difference as we think about the evolution of that business model between being dealing with stockholders and dealing with stakeholders. And I would argue that in our situation, we are dealing with stakeholders. And quite frankly, everybody in this room is a stakeholder. Everybody on this campus is a stakeholder. Everybody that surrounds this campus is a stakeholder. Think about the implications for that. You know, the CEO of a private corporation can go to Wilmington, Delaware and attend their board meeting and deal with the stockholders that show up. David Skorton, he can't go anywhere without running into a stakeholder. And what are the implications for that about how David does his job, how the provost does her job, how I do my job, how you do your jobs, when everybody has an ownership right to what it is that you do on a day-to-day basis? And what does that mean for the business model? How does that affect the business model? How does that affect the decision-making process? How does that affect how you think about how you go about doing your job every single day? Is that a bad business model? Is that a good business model? I'm not sure that's a relevant question because I don't think it's going to change. Because I think our business model accepts the fact that people have an ownership right in not-for-profit institutions. People have a legitimacy to ask questions about how we use the resources that we have given to us. People have a legitimate right to ask us about how we carry out our day-to-day business because there's an expectation in terms of the services that we will deliver back to society, back to our community. People have a right to expect us to be a good neighbor, to be a good citizen, because of the privileges and the benefits we have within this community that others don't have afforded to them, such as our tax-exempt status. And it is in this world that we have to ask ourselves as an administration, how are we supporting the tripartite mission of teaching, research, and service? And that's the interesting part for my organization, because my organization, I have to be able to find those hooks on a day-to-day basis that says, this is how you support Cornell's tripartite mission. This is how you support the teaching mission. This is how you support the research mission. This is how you provide help for services that the university delivers. Because on a day-to-day basis, in most cases, they don't have the same interactions, the same contacts that you all in this room have with faculty and students, where they don't have the direct linkage in a way where the institution affirms that you are critical to the ongoing operations of the institution, unless the president stands up or I stand up and remind them. And so getting them to understand that there is a true linkage and that there is an important role that they play in helping to develop the tripartite mission is absolutely critical. And so therefore, the initiatives that we pick in many instances have to be tied to or linked with that tripartite mission. And we'll talk a little bit about that as I go forward today. But I just want to conclude this section by also saying that one of the issues that we deal with, and I know I'm sure you all in this room deal with, is that Cornell is a city, and there's a tremendous complexity to that city. And it's how we, as an organization, my organization, help create the boundaries around which 30,000 people work and play and study and do great research and coexist on this campus is the most important thing that we do. That it's absolutely critical that we provide the environment around which all those activities can take place. And so understanding that's part of your role, understanding that's part of your responsibility, is the thing I spend a great deal of time talking about with my employees. So what's the model of the 21st century going to look like? Well, simplistically speaking, we've got to become much more agile. We're not going to get the resources. So we better figure out how we can evolve, how we can morph into something new, how we can adapt and adjust as the institution adapts and adjusts, because it's changing every single day all around us. You see it. You've done it. We just have to do it maybe in a little bit larger scale. But we all have to do it, and we all have to understand it. We clearly have a mantra of the highest quality service at the most efficient cost in the timeliest manner possible. I emphasize most of the time the timeliest manner possible. Cost is a given. Quality is a given. So really, it's the time in which we're able to deliver it, and that time is speeding. There's an acceleration that's taking place in terms of people's expectations of when they'll get the responses that they need, get the service that they require. And so we have to think about that. And some of that can be solved potentially by technology, but more importantly, most of that is going to be solved by rethinking our business processes and developing more efficient business processes so that we take the inefficiencies out of them such that we can respond more quickly. Now, that has a positive impact on costs. On the other hand, it may put some risk in the system if you don't take enough time to make sure that you do it right. But that becomes our challenge. And so we've worked as a leadership team on developing establishing a vision, identifying our mission and our values. We've tried to begin to work on defining roles and responsibilities. One of the things I'm very much attuned to from where I'm sitting is not only do I need to define the roles and responsibilities of my own organization and my own people, I also need to make sure that the perception of people's roles and responsibilities who interact with us are also well known and well understood, so that there's an acceptance that people are following their roles and responsibilities, are doing what it is that they're supposed to be doing, and conversely, that people accept that that's what their responsibility is. Stewardship is a given. But more importantly, I just want to focus and underline on the issue of people. People, to me, are the most important part of the equation. One, because I have a chance to lose 40% of them. Two, because, quite frankly, it's not the easiest place to recruit, and therefore homegrowning them is a very important part of what we do. Three, retention. If you think about what it costs you to replace somebody who's not happy and who leaves, the reality is we should be spending much more time in terms of thinking about how we provide people with the appropriate incentives, the appropriate environment in which to work, recognizing that it's not easy when you're going 24/7, 12 months a year. So thinking about our people, thinking about how we reward our people, thinking about how we incent our people, thinking about how we talk with our people, how we include them in the decision-making process is a very important part of what I think about and what my leadership team thinks about. And then I guess the last part of this is, and I've been having this conversation with a number of people, but I talk with my own team about it extensively. I think as an organization, we have to think about the resources that we are given as tax dollars. That people, no different than you paying to the city of Ithaca or to the state of New York or to the federal government, you're paying resources to us, which are just like taxes. And those, for those taxes, we should be delivering a set of services. And the challenge should be is to leverage those services as far out into the organization as conceivably possible. Because the farther those services can be leveraged out into the organization, the more bang for the buck you're going to get. And that's an extremely important issue in a decentralized organization like Cornell, because there are so many different component parts with so many different ways of doing them, or so many different ways that people would like to do them, that it becomes very difficult to get the economies and the efficiencies of scale. But the fact of the matter is if resources are going to continue to be tight, the farther we can stretch that rope, the farther we can leverage the tax dollars that are being paid, then the more effective we can be in terms of delivering services to our clients. And so the best way I know to do that is to spend a fair amount of time aligning what we're doing with what the units are doing, the colleges and the departments. And we're about to engage in a set of conversations with the College Officers Group where we're going to begin to look at opportunities to engage in conversations as to where we can figure out how we can better, more effectively stretch the rope to leverage the tax dollars that are out there. Because we're not going to go away. Those tax dollars aren't going to stop being paid. We're going to have a backbone in, network to run our high-speed computer systems. We're going to have a facilities department to oversee the buildings of our buildings. We're going to have a central financial function in order to ensure that we're using proper stewardship of the resources given. We have an absolute mandate for public safety, risk management, and for the protection of the people who live and work on this campus. So we're not going to go away. So what we need to do is we need to create a transparent structure where people can see how the resources that we are given are being used. We need to have a way of aligning how those resources are being used such that 90 to 95% of them are in alignment with what's happening out in the units so that people can leverage us more effectively. And then we need to understand that there's going to be 5%, 7% that we're going to negotiate every single year. In terms of is that the best and most appropriate use of resources. I think that's a great conversation. I tell my vice presidents, I think that's a great conversation. That's the conversation you should be having with your clients. Because it allows you to test whether or not you are aligned with where the institution thinks it's going. And that's what our role, that's what our responsibility has to be. If we think about how we are going to be good stewards of the resources that we are given. And at the end of the day, if we execute, then people should be rewarded. Execution should be rewarded. If you do it well, if you're successful, then the institution should recognize that. And it doesn't matter whether you're a vice president, a public safety officer, an account clerk, or an auditor. If you do it well, if you execute, you should be rewarded. I think in some respects some of this stuff is relatively novel. Talking to some of my peers across the country, this is just a conversation that's beginning to take place in a fundamental set of ways. And I have, you know, a degree of hope that Cornell can be a model. I think Cornell has an opportunity to be a model because, quite frankly, Cornell's been a model since its inception. It has bridged the gap between public and private. Its DNA is unique to any other institution in higher education. It attracts a set of people who want to come and work here who have a greater appreciation for the purpose of the institution and the role of the institution. And, quite frankly, I think that we have the capacity, if we work at it, to be a model in higher education. And so I want the people that are part of my organization to know and understand that as well. Because that gives them a sense of purpose, which is very important. So now, how do we apply this? How do we think about this? How do we put this together? Well, We begin with a mission statement, and again, I'm not going to go through every single one of these points. I'm just simply going to say that we think about it as a stewardship responsibility. We think about it as an opportunity to promote our people, to promote their capabilities. We think about it from the standpoint of how we align ourselves with what you and other people across the institution are doing. And we should be doing that every single day. When we get up in the morning, we should be thinking about it. When we go to work, we should be thinking about it. When we go home, we should be thinking about it. Because quite frankly, that's part of the business model which we live with today. Every single day, we should be thinking about how can we do our job better. And we should not be afraid to raise our hand and tell somebody, I think we can do it better if we do it this way. And we train our people through some of the organizational development programs that we run that it's all right to do that. And in fact, we encourage you to do that. That's part of our culture. We expect you to feel comfortable in doing that. We have a vision to be a standard bearer in the acquisition and management of financial facilities information resources, and we will accomplish this by a standard bearer. We debated that word among my senior leadership team for the longest period of time. Do we want to be best in class? Do we want to be the gold standard? What do we want to be? And what does it mean? What does it mean to be any one of those? And does the institution have the capacity to put the resources in place to be the best in class? We finally settled on the word standard bearer. Word standard bearer. Because that at least allowed us to sit there and say, we aspire to something. And it's important that we aspire to something. The institution aspires to be one of the leading teaching and research universities in the world. I don't think the administrative staff should be asked anything less themselves. They need to be a standard bearer. And so we talk about that, we think about that, we also think about how we judge that, how we evaluate that, while at the same time understanding that we have to be good stewards, we have to make tough decisions, we have to prioritize. We have to have a set of values. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on this other than to say that the values that we aspire to are basically the values that are aspired to by the institution. These you would find pretty much on the university website, maybe a few different words, but basically we aspire to that which from a set of values that the university itself talks about. And when we put all that together, we developed a set of goals, and we hope that those goals will inform, if you will, how we go about maximizing the use of the resources that we are given. And these goals are a little bit different than goals that you will probably see a year from now. If only because these goals were crafted before President Skorton announced his goals several weeks ago at the Alumni Council weekend. And while a number of these would fall under one of those goals, and that's really the intent of the document that President Skorton is working on, some of these goals would be probably shaped a little bit differently in order to ensure that there's closer alignment between the institutional overarching goals and, quite frankly, the goals that will emanate from the colleges and the departments to whom we provide services. But as an exercise, we spent a great deal of time reaching out to the provost and reaching out to the colleges in order to identify what their goals were so that we could determine whether our goals were in alignment under this theory of stretching the rope. That was the first time that the organization had ever done an exercise like that, and they actually found out it was quite interesting because it began to have their organizations begin to ask questions about why are we doing this when this seems to be of a higher priority to the institution, and if we change this to this, does that allow us to reprioritize resources in ways that can more effectively be used? So the exercise was actually a very good exercise. And we spent a great deal of time with it. We spent probably 2.5-3 days working our way through that. And I'm going to now take a couple of these, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how that plays out in terms of how we operationalize this whole process. The first one is design a comprehensive approach to developing talent and filling succession pipeline in critical university roles. This is the whole issue of succession planning. It is something that we, as I've said earlier, we have to think a great deal about. Cornell has a great track record. Cornell has probably one of the best track records in the administrative units in the area of succession planning through the work that Hal Kraft has done, through the Hal Kraft Leadership Council, and now also through the Turning Point program that's run through the organizational development group that is aligned with human resources. When I first came, the one complaint that I had about it was only CUFA employees that attended it. I actually went through the full 10-day program. It's sort of like total immersion, a big group hug. And after 10 days, you actually do need a group hug. But the objective of it was to sort of cross-pollinate. And at the end of the day, I said, you know, this was really good for me because I spent 10 days with 20 people who work within my organization, from pipe fitters to account clerks to this to that. So I had basically a total immersion in my organization, but they only had contact with me. And while that was great, you know, what they didn't have contact with was somebody from arts and sciences, or somebody from vet, or somebody from the library, or somebody from you name it, who, if there had been a cross-pollinization, you'd actually begin to think about how could you create a university culture of administration? How could you begin to think about creating a university philosophy of administration? How could you think about building bridges between the center and the colleges and the departments that allow for a greater commonality of understanding that we're all in this together? That there isn't much difference between financial stewardship at the Department of Finance and Administration and financial stewardship in the College of Arts and Sciences or in the vet school. That there's not a lot of difference between human resource management in OHR and human resource management in the library or in some other institution. That there's not a great deal of difference between facilities management or technology data administration or risk management between what goes on in the center, what goes on out in the colleges and the departments. The responsibility is the same. The job's the same. The difference is where your office is and who you interact with on a day-to-day basis. And so figuring out how to cross-pollinate so that people understand that there's a tremendous amount of commonality in what we do is absolutely critical. And this is one of the skills that we want to teach our people and our organization about. We want them to build those bridges. We want them to build those relationships. We want to create that set of communal understandings so that it becomes easier organizationally to stretch that rope farther in order to more effectively better leverage the resources that are provided. Succession planning is absolutely critical. It's critical in terms of the training programs. It's also critical in terms of recruitment. And so, you know, again, I'm not going to belabor the point. I'm just going to simply say we've talked about the 40%. We've talked about location. We've talked about external competition, tremendous amount of external competition. I have people from my organization who are being recruited all the time. It's a wonderful problem to have. It means you have good people. It's a bad problem to have. It means you've got to replace them. So thinking about succession planning, thinking about how we create a career ladder is absolutely important. And even more than that, thinking about how we create the next generation of higher education administrative leadership is also critical. It's not a field that people are running to get into. There is a, for example, at my level, the running joke is right now, when one of us retires, all the headhunters do is they pick up the telephone and they call my peers in 10 other institutions and they ask them if they're ready to move yet. That's a problem. So how are we going to develop the next generation of leadership for ourselves? So we spent a great deal of time thinking about how do we provide an individual path? And my HR people working with OHR think about, one, how do we sit with our own employees and how do we help our own employees think about their career path and the opportunities and how do we provide them with those opportunities? We also think about it from an organizational perspective, thinking about where are the holes that we're going to have and how do we think about how we're going to fill those holes or what are the challenges to filling those holes and coming up with a broader comprehensive plan, if you will. And then how do we link the opportunities with people in such a way that we can begin to give people the opportunity to test themselves, to experiment, to see whether or not they like those opportunities, and to begin to gauge for ourselves whether or not we have the kind of people whom we can reach into our own organization and pull out and move up into new job opportunities. And we have a whole series of skill sets, and here the point of this slide is really basically to say organizations need to make investments in these areas. We need to spend money. We need to hire people. We need to have programs in all of these areas if we are going to be successful. Because really it's an investment in the institution that is absolutely critical long term. When we think about succession planning, when we think about the future, we also have to think about the fact that it does require the expenditure of a set of resources if we are going to do it successfully. And it is something from an institutional perspective I think we need to do more of. And I think that Mary Opperman and OHR have demonstrated an understanding for that, and they certainly are working with my organization as far as that's concerned. Another area that we're focused on, and this is a broad institutional priority, is the whole issue of sustainability. Here, I think what's interesting is that when I first came to Cornell 2.5 years ago, my first experience at Cornell was Redbud Woods. How many people remember Redbud Woods? Well, I spent 20 days walking around Redbud Woods, meeting all of the nice kids and a number of faculty members who I never knew. I mean, I was just there a month, and learning about the issues and the politics of Ithaca. That was interesting, also learning that there was, not an insignificant interest in the area of sustainability. Out of that, I hired a sustainability coordinator, Dean Koyanagi, we hired Dean on a one-year contract and said, let's see where we want to go as an institution in sustainability. And the first year was kind of interesting. We sort of meandered around. And then David Skorton came, and within 8 months, we had signed the President's Climate Commitment. The President's Climate Commitment commits this institution to having a carbon neutral position by the year 2050. Now, that's assuming technology gets there, but that's really not the issue. What the issue is what the institution's going to have to do every year to think about its environmental footprint and how we create a culture of sustainability across the entire institution in order to achieve that. Because it's not going to be accomplished by somebody coming up with just simply a new technology that says, do this and everything goes away. It's things like lake source cooling. which we did 10 years ago, which has allowed us to actually add over 2 million square feet of new buildings to this campus while still having our carbon emissions decline over that period because we haven't had to use any of the chillers that we used to have on this campus. It's things like the heat and combined heat and power plant, cogeneration, that we will bring online in the year 2009, which will actually eliminate up to 50% of the coal that we burn on this campus every single year. So it is a culture of sustainability. But more importantly, it is beyond that, it is a combination of economic, social, and environmental issues that come together across the campus, combining faculty, students, and staff. And here what I would want to point out in terms of this issue is 10 days ago I attended the Board of Trustees meeting, and at the Board of Trustees meeting, the Dean of the Faculty, Charlie Walcott, stood up, and he said, "I just want to commend to the trustees the fact that Cornell's administrative units are probably the leaders in higher education in the area of environmental sustainability." He said, "I want the trustees to know that in most institutions, administrators are seen as an impediment to change, where here at Cornell, it's the administration that has led the institution into the era of environmental sustainability." Now, that was a little bit of hyperbole, but not as much as you would think when you think of the issues like lake source cooling, which was completely unique and novel, and for which it was a combination of the utilities department and the faculty working together with the community to develop an approach that was acceptable and implementable. And today, that has eliminated tens of thousands of carcinogens and other things that go into the air out of smokestacks that we no longer have to use across all of our buildings because the utility department was a leader and innovator in that regard. And what Charlie's broader point was is that he had great hope for the future that between the administration and the faculty, Cornell could actually be a living laboratory in the area of sustainability such that we actually lived what we espoused. And that's where we begin to think about how we link administrators and faculty together such that you feel that you are part of the tripartite mission of the university. That when you can have that kind of connectivity on a day-to-day basis, it allows us as a organization to feel that we are truly connected to. But it is also part of the business model. Why is it a part of the business model? It's a part of the business model because we are now linking our functionality with that of the academic core, the research core, and we are making it possible for us to actually be a part of the evolution, the change that's taking place, and that we can be a facilitator of that change. And when we understand that we can be a facilitator of that change, then we're much more receptive to change ourselves. And that's part of the nimbleness, and that's part of the adaptability that we have to have if we are to be successful. So sustainability is a wonderful role model for our organization right now in terms of helping us think through not only how we can adapt and how we can adjust, but also how we can align ourselves in ways that are going to be truly fun to work with. I put this slide up only so that you can see these are going to be the areas that are going to be debated over the next year and a half, as we think about the President's climate commitment. These are going to be the areas for which we are going to define aspirational goals in the area of sustainability for the institution. And in each of these, quite frankly, there are links right out to the research core, the faculty, and to the students, and the faculty and the students will be partners with us as we develop the aspirational goals in these areas. And just as President Scorton said just a couple of days ago, We don't have much time. We have to start cracking. Aligning our operations with our comprehensive planning initiatives. I'm just going to take just a minute or two. You will be seeing over the course of the next several months a conversation on the comprehensive master plan. I think you have probably been engaged by the consultants or participated in some of the forums that we've been running. What I want to do is go quickly through a series of slides very quickly to get to the last slide, which is really where I want to spend my time talking. But basically today we have 14 million square feet on this campus. Majority of that has been built in the last 50 years. We have about 2.8 million square feet that we could prune selectively. That would allow us to recapture land for future use. We have about another 3.4 million that we could have adaptive reuse, which means that we could quite frankly reprogram them for those facilities for other activities, maybe some of the same but maybe improved. We have a number of development sites that could support anywhere between 4.5 million and 10 million new gross square feet if we wanted to add that much over the next 60 years. And we have linked those, if you will, in a series of connectivities between the academic mission of the university and the administrative units that need to support those academic units. We have thought about those from an administration perspective, issues around housing for students, the role of athletics, but I would actually talk to you more about the role of student spaces, community spaces across campus, similar to some of those that you've built within the library system. And then there is a whole debate that the planners are having around creating a new destination point on campus to link the East and the West a little bit more closely than has been historically. The point that I want to make here is, for the first time in a very, very, very long time, and you'd probably have to go back to maybe even the 19th century, there is actually a document that allows administrators and academics to sit down and talk strategically about how the campus should evolve, rather than having an ad hoc conversation that says, well, I want to build a building here, or I want to do something here, or I want to do this. There's actually a document that you can sit down and say, you know, we need a new research facility, and it's going to house one of these and two of these and five of these. And the administrative side of the house is going to be able to sit down and say, that's interesting. Here are some development sites, and here are some proximity issues, and here are some other issues that you probably need to think about as you think about where to site the building, how big the building should be, and what the points of interconnectivity are. And one of the points that we make within our own organizational unit is that planning is not a bad thing. It actually can be quite helpful. Not that it sets anything in stone, but rather it provides you with a framework around which to have a conversation. And the linkage in the business model that's absolutely so, one of the linkages in the business model that's so important for the future of institutions like Cornell, major complex research institutions, is communication. It's the ability to have a conversation where everybody understands what the stakes are, what's on the table, what are the issues, where there's a clarity such that as you're seeking to find a solution, there's not a lot of gray, but there's much more clarity in terms of what it is that you're trying to accomplish. And the more that we, from our side of the table, can create that clarity, the more effective we can be in terms of serving our clients, in terms of providing the services. And so planning is not a bad thing. It's not the end of the sum and substance of everything we do. It cannot be the sum and substance of everything we do because, as I've already said, we're an institution that's evolving very quickly. But it is an important component of what we do because if we have a roadmap, if we have to diverge, we at least have a means of understanding why we diverged and where it was that we were trying to get to. So an important part of our business model as we move forward is actually having a structure around which to engage conversations. And now the last area I want to talk about is in the area of health, safety, health, and environmental risk management. And here what I want to do is I want to make the case about the sort of the evolution, the change that is taking place. And again, one of the things I love to do with the groups that I talk to within my own organization is I like to ask the question, in the 50s and 60s, what were the big issues? What did people worry about? What kept you awake at night? What were the big, big problems that people said, I haven't done my job today if I haven't gone home and worried about X or Y? And the answer in the 50s and 60s was pretty simple. It was people, it was buildings, and it was dollars. You know, if you took care of your people, you took care of your buildings, and you managed your resources well, yeah, you're probably a pretty good administrator. You're probably doing a pretty good job. In the late 70s, early 80s, and into the 90s, that all changed. It was no longer people, dollars, and buildings. Something else was added to it. Data. The IT revolution changed the entire way we had to think. Right? Now all of a sudden, people were walking around with huge databases that if somebody could hack their way into, they had a field day. It was like hitting a gold mine. And the risk to the institution was even more significant if they got into, of all things, Social Security numbers. So data became a huge issue in the 80s and early 90s. And then that changed after 2000. 9/11, Virginia Tech. Now, we not only have to worry about people, buildings, dollars, data, we also have to manage risk in a much more fundamental way. And so out of that, the business of our organizations have really changed because the nature of what we had to manage changed. And so today we've spent a lot of time focusing on all of the finances, all of the IT stuff, all of the HR stuff, and so forth. And you know, when you looked at the issues around risk, we had risk reporting to five different vice presidents, not to one single organization. And so 6 months ago, we announced a reorganization where we brought all of our risk together, risk management functions together, under a new vice president with a purpose of putting one person in control. Now, interestingly enough, the announcement came a week after Virginia Tech, but the fact of the matter is I think most people in this room would know that you never do anything in a week in Cornell. So it obviously had to be in the works before the announcement, and we've been working on it for about a year. I just want to point out here, because of that, over the course of the summer, we were able to do a whole series of things which quite frankly, we would not have been able to do if we had not restructured our organization in order to manage risk. We were able to develop an oversight structure that ensures that institutionally we are able to bring all the appropriate elements of the campus together to think about risk management. We were able to undertake a series of planning functions, some of which you are doing in the libraries as well as the colleges and departments are doing to ensure that we have the right plans in place and people know what they're supposed to do in the time of the risk, and also that we have the right policies. And these are all a work in process, but quite frankly, from what I'm able to tell from talking to my peers, we're doing a pretty good job as compared to our other institutions. We're also able to deal with the emergency communication infrastructure questions. And while this, again, is not sort of a panacea, I mean, the fact of the matter is one of the things that we're actually be putting up pretty soon is a siren. You know, who would think? But the fact of the matter is that a siren may be more effective than any text message, any email, any cell phone or anything else. So it's not a high-tech issue. It's really having the procedures and the protocol that's in place. And we've done a lot of training, and we will do even more training. And we will do localized-based training with units. Because part of our responsibility, part of our business model is that we need to be a service provider to the units. Units that don't have the expertise in safety, security, and emergency response, or who don't have the resources to do that, we need to be a service provider. Such that if you have to make a telephone call that says, we've got a problem, we know that you've got the organization, the processes in place such that when we show up at the front door, we're able to interact well together. We've stretched that rope just that much farther so that we can align ourselves at that point in crisis such that everybody feels good that we've got the appropriate responses. So in conclusion, what I would just want to say to you is that, you know, the business model that we're talking about is really a work in progress. It's not complete, and it probably won't be complete for a long time. But it has a pretty clear philosophy in terms of we want to be a more effective partner with our units, with our clients, with the people who depend on us for the service. We want to be extremely transparent. We want to make sure that the resources that we're given, we are using them in the most productive and effective way possible, recognizing that on the margins, 5%, 7%, we'll always be debating that because we'll have our view of how we should be using those resources and you'll have yours. But you know, 7% is a heck of a lot better than 90% or 80%. And we have a model that quite frankly is views itself as providing for greater clarity, greater understanding about what we're about, what we're trying to do, that people accept what our role and responsibility is on this campus, that they know that we have aspirational goals, that those aspirational goals are tied to the tripartite mission of the institution, and that every day that we come to work, regardless of whether or not we're a janitor or a groundskeeper or a vice president or a public safety official or whomever we are, that part of our responsibility is to think about how can we do this job better? How can we provide more effective service? How can we manage the risks of this institution in a more appropriate way? And to not be afraid to be able to bring those issues up to anybody within the management infrastructure in order to allow those ideas to receive a full and fair airing. And quite frankly, well, I didn't talk a lot about it, but one that's one of our goals is to develop appropriate measures in order to assess our progress. Simple, but quite frankly, one of the biggest risks that people are most concerned with, which is, you're going to measure me? Well, the fact of the matter is we're in a culture of measurement. And we might as well accept that. And if we measure ourselves, then we can probably make the changes much more quickly and more effectively than by having somebody try to impose them on us. So that's pretty much what we're about, and we spend a great deal of time on it, and we'll continue to spend a great deal of time on it. Thank you.